Our first case for argument, United States v. James, Mr. Reskoski.
Good morning. Mr. James' case was predicated on two pieces of evidence, a government informant setting up, escalating, and delivering a sting to the government using a hidden recording device. Despite the fact that everyone recognized that this recording device was the integral piece of evidence at trial, Mr. James and his trial counsel were denied the right to ever examine or even see that recording device. Likewise, the jury and the court were denied the right to see that as well.
What had you hoped to show by examining the device? What were you hoping to be able to argue to the jury as a result?
Well, there were several things, and one of those things was whether the device could be turned on or off. There were issues where the informant disappeared that day. What happened is the device did not actually work or was not turned on the day of the actual sting.
But didn't the stipulation stipulate that it could be turned on or off?
It did address that, but that's only one of the purposes, Your Honor. There were many other purposes. And frankly, whenever we look at evidence, there's always a multitude of purposes that we discover once we actually get to look at that evidence. Some of those pieces of evidence could include it would allow them to make a properly informed decision about going to trial. It could allow them to investigate why the voices were so hard to hear on the tapes. Again, this was the same recording device that was used previously. And in the testimony, if you look at the record, the transcripts, or listen to the tapes themselves from these previous incidents, the voices, particularly Mr. James, are very hard to hear. Mr. James and his counsel were entitled to investigate those and all other things that weren't covered by the stipulation in this case that could have been helpful either at trial or investigating whether to go to trial in the first place. Likewise, it would be allowed to investigate the informant's activities. Again, in this case, there was about a 10-minute period where the informant disappeared from the scope of the government's scan.
I don't understand how looking at the device allows you to investigate the informant's activities when the device isn't on.
Well, that's the question. I guess the question is whether the device was manipulated, what could be done to manipulate the device, whether the device was defective in some manner, and other things along those lines as well. Again, it also goes to the question, Your Honor, of reaching the questions of, you know, how is this device used? What makes this device so difficult to hear? Were Mr. James' words on these transcripts and these, you know, or on these tapes and later transcribed onto transcripts are so difficult to decipher? Those tapes were the key evidence at trial, and those transcripts were the key evidence at trial, and Mr. James should have been entitled to do any investigation that he please on this recording device.
Well, that's not the law, though. I mean, the any investigation you please on the device doesn't strike me as consistent with the court's general power to enter orders that are just under the circumstances governing this kind of thing. The judge thinks that by the time you have in your stipulation your ability to argue that it might have been on, might have been off, the jury would have known it was a very faint recording. So to the extent you have disputes about what Mr. James said, you can argue that, right?
Well, and that was one part that was allowed to argue via the stipulation. But the second part of the stipulation allowed this evidence to be withheld due to a privilege that the court deemed valid. And that's the part that we're taking issue with here, Your Honor. It's that issue that would have allowed Mr. James to do other further investigation. Under Rule 16, Mr. James was allowed to investigate and, in fact, move for the right to investigate any evidence that the government would use during its case in chief or any evidence that was material. This recording device clearly fit within both of those standards. It was used by the government during its case in chief, and it was material. Without this recording device, the government didn't have anything. They didn't call the informant.
Why didn't you follow up further then and not stop with the stipulation? I mean, the government argues that you kind of dropped the ball at that. Were you trial counsel?
I was not trial counsel, Your Honor.
Who? So I'm not being personal.
But the defense
dropped the ball and didn't pursue this.
Well, the answer is they did. They filed a motion ahead of time. They had convinced the trial court that this evidence should have been turned over. And in fact, after the first day of trial, the government agreed to live with the court's expectation that this was turned over. The following day, they brought in U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald, right, who then convinced the court otherwise. Trial counsel, defense counsel repeatedly objected and said this evidence is fundamental, but we're now in the middle of trial. We now have the trial court's feelings that this evidence was perhaps a stipulation where he would allow it for certain purposes would do. That was a reversal of his prior position. We're now in the middle of trial. It's not an appropriate point at that point. Frankly, trial counsel's position was, had the government felt this strongly about it, they should have raised it previously. Trial counsel, you know, looking at the record, did all they could. They objected, but when they were beat, they entered into a stipulation where they got as much as they could out of it. But that doesn't mean they got everything they should have got out of that recording device and that they were entitled to.
I want to ask you a question about this self-representation mess that occurred, because it strikes me that since, rightly or wrongly, the trial court judge allowed hybrid representation, that we might need to ask what was the harm to Mr. James from that. And I'm having troubles, given that the lawyer was there, by this time this is Mr. Sternberg, right?
He had a separate trial counsel, a separate
right,
sentencing
various
counsel,
people
and then I'm
enter
now an appellate
and
counsel.
Exit. But he got the benefits of representation by an attorney, and he actually also gets the benefits, to the extent he thought he wanted them, of his own input into the trial. So where is he harmed by this?
Was in allowing the inconsistent arguments. In this case, Mr. Sternberg presented a position. It's the same position that we presented to some degree in our appellate briefs, when looking at the guidelines as a starting point, that the base level, based on the evidence presented, the instructions to the jury, the indictment, should have been at a base level of 32. Mr. James took an inconsistent position that it should have been a base level of 12. The harm is when presenting those inconsistent positions, neither one of them ends up getting credited. In these cases, the idea of not allowing this joint or hybrid representation or providing a proper Faretta warning.
I don't understand you. The 12 was pretty ridiculous, so why wouldn't the 32 be credible with the judge, and better 32 than, you know, 40 or whatever?
Well, I guess I just look at it from a common sense perspective. You know, whenever I have one of my...
common sense seems to me go the other way. You've got the lawyer as a backup there making a credible argument and giving him another shot. Look, it's very common, even for lawyers, obviously, to argue in the alternative. Say, well, I should be a 12, but not a 12, certainly shouldn't be more than 32, right? Isn't that what it amounts to here?
Lawyers often do argue in that term. The difference is, again, you're having, you know, two very different arguments over the same thing.
Yeah, but sure. The lawyer said, you know, our preferred position is 12, but our backup is 32. Nothing wrong with that. So it's given by two people rather than one. Why is that a problem?
The second thing then as well is just the harm in general, where Mr. James took the position at sentencing that he alone wanted to present his sentencing argument. The trial court may have found that to be an incredible argument. If I raised it here, which we haven't, you could find that to be an incredible argument. But under those circumstances, having made that repeatedly clear.
I have a cake and eat it. I mean, he either has a right to represent himself, or if he doesn't, if he has the right, he can make ridiculous arguments. Right?
Well, and that's unfortunately.
I have a lawyer to make the rewrite. He makes the ridiculous arguments. The lawyer makes the sober arguments. Why isn't that the best of both worlds for him?
Well, again, by presenting what you've described as a wild and crazy argument, it certainly does not benefit his cause.
Well, that's Faretta.
That's the question. It's not just what harm is.
These people who represent themselves, of course, they always screw up. But if they have a lawyer there, you know, to back them up, that makes them better off, not worse off.
Well, the question is, you know, again, in this circuit, joint representation is not encouraged if that is going to be allowed.
Yeah, right, because it's not encouraged because, of course, the government doesn't want to face the two opponents. But but I don't see why it isn't in the defendant's interest, right? The concern with hybrid representation is the lawyer gets up and, I mean, the client gets up and he, you know, makes his arguments and so on. But then when you have to cross-examine or something requiring skill, the lawyer takes over, so it's hitting the government from two angles. That's why hybrid representation is usually not permitted, but I don't see how it hurts defendants.
Well, Mr. James, for the reasons previously stated, would respectfully disagree. I see my lights
on. It's worse than to have three lawyers than to have one lawyer.
Sometimes that's the case. You know, sometimes too many too many cooks spoil the broth, so to speak. Okay, I saw my light was on to reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Hayes?
May it please the Court. Valerie Hayes on behalf of the United States. Appellant's counsel raises several arguments, none of which justify vacating the sentence of Mr. James. I first want to address the exclusion of the recording equipment as evidence at trial. Mr. James waived all objections to this issue because he agreed to a stipulation in lieu of a ruling by the district court on this matter.
But the stipulation isn't quite as clean as, I mean, it doesn't seem to me it necessarily covers the whole range of things. There's this privilege, this unspoken privilege, the government, it just says, it sort of states as a fact that the government has declined to produce pursuant to privilege which the court has deemed valid. It doesn't say that the defendant agrees that that privilege is valid. It accurately reports the court thinks so. I don't see how that stipulation is a concession that the privilege is in fact valid.
Well, I think the important thing is that prior to entering into the stipulation, the district court indicated that it was inclined to let the defense inspect the equipment and just suggested that over the weekend, if the parties could come up with a stipulation that they both agreed to, then that would be, you know, an alternative solution.
Well, that's a statement of fact. But then when this stipulation, I read this as leaving open the possibility to argue that the defendant takes issue with the court's decision that it's valid. It's not the same as in contrast to the sentence that precedes it, where the stipulation says the device was capable of being turned on and off by the government agents. Okay, that issue's now off the table. Everybody agrees the device can do that. But I don't know that there's as much waiver as the government likes to think here.
I think the purpose of that latter part of the stipulation was to give the jury an explanation as to why the government was not willing to produce the equipment.
Why do you have to tell the jury that? Why can't you just say it's stipulated between the parties that the recording device wasn't malfunctioning and it could be turned off and on? You don't usually tell the jury all about why the government has adopted a certain strategy. Why would they even be thinking about why the government did or didn't produce the device?
That was part of the stipulation that the defense wanted. The district court had said, though, that he was inclined to let them see it, and the stipulation was not something they were required to do once he had ruled that they could not see it. He never made that ruling. And the stipulation actually gave the defense more than it would have gotten had it gotten to see the equipment. It was able to make the argument. The only argument they expressed any interest in arguing was that the informant was able to manipulate the equipment, turn it on and off. That's what the stipulation gave them, and they, in fact, utilized the stipulation throughout the trial.
Right. I mean, that's a different argument on your part, and maybe they got, as a factual matter, what they needed, but I don't think that's waiver so much as the scope of the stipulation. I mean, when the U.S. attorney himself shows up in court and tells the judge that the world's going to come to an end if this device is seen by anybody, the district judge obviously reconsidered his position on what that order might be.
But even after that point, after Mr. Fitzgerald had spoken to the district court still told the defense counsel that he was still inclined to let them see the equipment, and they basically did not pursue that. Instead, they did agree to a stipulation, presumably because they realized the stipulation would help them more than the jury actually getting to see the equipment.
And how did this, I mean, it's really a shame that this Feretta mess occurred the way it did, because the truth is, when all sorts of different people are making arguments, the defendant is never told, as our cases require in terms of his own participation, the things that we have usually looked for, in no particular formula of words, but we've looked for a much stronger set of warnings than what this district court gave. I've looked at all the different parts of the transcript, and he never really sits down and goes through any kind of Feretta-type warning. I think he thinks because he's allowing hybrid representation, that's enough. But then there's Mr. James just kind of saying all these things, which I think, easily could have an adverse effect on his position before the sentencing judge.
The sentencing judge did tell Mr. James several times that he's taking a risk by speaking on his own behalf.
Right, but you know what the cases say. I mean, again, it's not a particular formula of words. This court's never required, you know, marching through the bench book or anything like that. But the advice has to be given. You are undertaking something of great importance. You're making a big mistake. You know, this never works for people. You know, on and on. Very strong and simple to understand language has to be used. And I don't see Judge Anderson doing that here.
In your experience, are these defendants ever dissuaded by these warnings?
Honestly, Your Honor, I've never had a case before where the defendant had asked to speak on his own behalf. Personally, the issue's never come up with me before, but I unfortunately did not handle the sentencing. But from reading the transcript, it appeared to me that the district court did tell him that it would be unwise not to utilize Mr. Sternberg. He went into the fact that Mr. Sternberg cares about him. He's a smart attorney. He should use him. And he did, in fact, use him. This was hybrid representation, and it's the government's position that in this type of case, Feretta warnings don't apply because there's two purposes of Feretta warnings. One, to warn the defendant that it's not wise to speak on his own behalf, and second, the disadvantages of not having the expertise of counsel. In this case, he had the expertise of counsel, so the Feretta warnings are not really applicable in the hybrid representation scheme.
But we do have a standard of review problem, because if there's a clear case of somebody trying to assert his Feretta rights, and you know, that people have, and the district court doesn't let him represent himself. This is not something that's subject to harmless error analysis. It really couldn't be, you know, when you consider how foolish it is normally for people to do that. So that's one possibility. And, of course, the Supreme Court has reinforced just recently one's right to have the lawyer of one's choice, even if it's in a retained counsel setting. So a question I have is whether in this messy hybrid situation, whether we can even ask the harmless error question for Mr. James. I would suspect if we can ask it, it would be awfully hard to show that he was prejudiced by what went on because Mr. Sternberg was there. He was making, as Judge Posner said, the credible arguments. But whether we can get that far is my question.
Oh, I think we can get that far. The district court actually made it very clear to Mr. James that if he wanted to represent himself completely by himself, with make all the arguments, none from counsel, he could do that. And additionally, throughout the proceedings, the district court repeatedly asked Mr. James, is this hybrid, I mean, he didn't use the word hybrid representation, but is this what you want? Mr. Sternberg still making representations for you, and you arguing on his own behalf. The defendant repeatedly said that is what he wanted. It's not a situation where the district court wouldn't let him speak solely on his own behalf. He made that option available, and Mr. James declined that offer because he wanted the benefit of the expertise of his attorney.
Ms. Hayes, with respect to the hearsay testimony and its impact, I'd like to hear what you have to say about about its impact on the closing argument. Is there any way we can really be assured that that testimony, after it was admitted, was not referred to by the United States in the closing argument, that it did not have an impact on the jury in that respect?
Well, Your Honor, I think there were several references through closing arguments and rebuttal to Mr. James being a drug dealer.
Yes.
And I don't believe that the basis for that was the hearsay statements that came in about his prior acts of drug dealing.
But how can I be assured that belief is grounded in the record?
Because you look at the other evidence that came in through the trial that established the same thing. The fact that on the recordings, he was clearly showing his, you know, past in drug dealing by talking about, you know, telling the informant, this is the way we do it, and I can sell my share of the kilos in a very short number of days, and referring to how we've done it in the past. And there was a lot of different ways. And even just within this case, the 15 kilos at issue made him a drug dealer. So when we were saying, and we didn't, there were no references to the CI talking about the 1 kilo and the 98 kilogram deal, other than in the sense of, I think there was one reference to responding to their arguments about the integrity in the investigation.
Did the district court take any steps to ensure that testimony wasn't used?
Yes, Your Honor.
As substantive evidence?
He gave a limiting instruction to the jury once that evidence came in that they were only to consider it for the purpose of evaluating the integrity of the government's investigation.
I I see. Thank you.
Thank you. My time's almost up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Mr. Raskoski, your time ran out, but you can have a minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. Taking on the question that was raised in regard to the hearsay testimony, Ms. Hayes is correct. There was a limiting instruction given the first time this evidence was used. The contention in this case, though, is that then the government then far exceeded that limiting instruction during their closing argument and subsequently. They didn't just use it for the limited purpose. They used it to prove the truth of the matter asserted.
What do you mean by closing argument and subsequently?
Both subsequently, there was additional testimony that was entered or provided by other agents in which
after the closing argument?
No, I'm sorry. The testimony from Agent Dee Podesta, the first person to testify about these other alleged drug deals, happened on the first or the second day of trial. There was then another agent who later testified and provided some more information about these drug deals as well as the use of the informant to close out all these other notorious drug dealers throughout the city. The problem here is the government far exceeded that limiting instruction. The only evidence about the 15 kilograms in this case came from the mouth of the informant. The government then used that to talk about one time before to argue that this showed a series of drug dealing and to portray Mr. James as a notorious drug dealer who was involved in all sorts of criminal activities. That was improper, and it certainly far exceeded the Confrontation Clause standards that are set forth here in Silva and in other circuits, the Sixth Circuit and Cromer, etc.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Raskoski. And you were appointed, were you not?
I was.
Thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you very much.